Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me, I'm going solo, but I don't mind going solo on this one because I have Jeff Horn, who's a historian who specialises in Russian politics, US-Russian relations, and he's here to talk to us about the Russian constitutional crisis of 1993. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So excited because I can finally have a podcast where, okay, we're going to be serious, but we can also have a bit of a laugh because we get to laugh at Russia, and who doesn't like to laugh at Russia? So.
Yeah, well, that's, when you look at Russian history, it really does prove Marx's theory that history begins as a tragedy and ends in a farce. So there's a lot to laugh and cry about in the 1990s because so much of what happened was so ridiculous. But at the same time, I at least believe there was an opportunity for a much better world that was fundamentally lost because of people's egos and inability to think about the long term and the big picture.
So one of our regular hosts here, she likes to do a lot of old stuff. And she always says, if, you know, anything really in the 20th century is not actually history, what would you say to that little line there, that what we're going to be talking about today is not actually history?
Okay, so this is an issue I run into with my research. When I tell people what I research and they're like, well, that's not history because I remember it. And I'm somewhere on the line of what is and isn't. Officially, the use of history is to be able to use primary source documents. And fortunately, the US and UK governments have actually come up with a time frame of what can be considered history and what's not. And that's 25 to 30 years after it's happened, because that's when the classification runs out. And that's when documents are declassified. So you can actually get in and examine the primary sources. And what I found doing this project is, yes, it's fairly contemporary, but it's very relevant to the world we're living in today. And there's, despite being so much in the recent past, there is a lot of misunderstanding. And there's a lot of narrow perspective, especially by people who remember it, because people looked at it from their singular perspective. And when you bring in other perspectives, you get a much broader, much more complex picture that can lead you to a completely different conclusion about what happens. So I do think it is technically history. It's been 30 years now since the constitutional crisis. It's been over 30 years since the collapse of the USSR. My supervisor, Vladislav Zubok, published his book, Collapse, which is about the collapse of the USSR roughly 30 years after it had ended. I'm hoping my own book, which will hopefully come out in the next couple of years, will come out around the same gap of time frame. So I'm on the first iteration of history. Right on the edge. And some people I know will never get over that because, well, let's face it, they think everything that happened after Alexander the Great is recent events.
I've got to say, I do not believe that 1993 was over 30 years ago. That makes me old. So that's going to start giving away my age now, because I was 6 when this all happened. So there we go. Anyway, look, why don't we get into this? Because some of our listeners might not actually be able to understand what is going on in the world, in Europe at the time. Talk us through, I mean, go back as far as you need to. Talk us through the kind of idea of what we're looking at this time.
Well, so it's an interesting story, and it's closely intertwined with the Soviet Union, which was a country born out of revolution, violence, regicide, and had a very fundamental ideological way of looking at the world, and had a leadership, especially Vladimir Lenin, who was very convinced that he was going to create the final society using scientific Marxism. And of course, none of that worked out the way they thought it was. And what you see, especially after the death of Stalin, which, by the way, excellent film, if you haven't seen it. what you see after the death of Stalin is a gradual effort, first under Khrushchev and then under Brezhnev, to normalize the relations in the Soviet Union between the government and the people. And they do this in a number of ways. There's the changes in the economic policies where under Khrushchev, they start to prioritize standard of living, increase housing, increase production of consumer goods. And then under Brezhnev, that continues. And then there's also, very broadly speaking, the legal reforms. Stalin had instituted a constitution in 1936, the Stalinist constitution, which was the most liberal and democratic constitution in the world, except that it wasn't worth the paper it was written on, as we all know. But in 1977, Brezhnev finalizes the revisions of the Soviet constitution. This will actually be the fourth one they've gone through for the USSR. And then the constituent republics, of which there were 15, follow along a year later. And what's interesting about this constitution is that it actually lays out, nominally at least, the way that what the citizens can expect from the state and what the state expects from its citizens. And obviously, the actual application of it was not, you know, there, especially on the legal mechanisms. It gave lots of power to the formal government, but of course, all power was still held by the party. Interesting fun fact, the 1936 Constitution was the first constitution to actually mention the Communist Party. And it wasn't until 1977, its role in society as the vanguard of, you know, everything was actually enshrined into law. And it wasn't working. Everyone knew it wasn't working. The economic system wasn't working. The political system wasn't working. It's that I'm not sure who said it, but he really hit the nail on the head. We pretended to work and they pretended to pay us. Everything was broken. And so what you get in the 1980s is you actually do, after Brezhnev dies, because the Brezhnev period is often called stagnation, because high international oil prices, they were able to sell off raw materials, especially oil, for foreign currency to buy consumer goods and also to buy things they needed like wheat. And they just let their own domestic industries rot. There is a fascinating PhD to be written. I don't know who would fund it, but there's a fascinating PhD to be written on the collapse of Soviet agriculture. It goes from being the world's leading exporter of wheat in the 1930s to something like to being a net importer of wheat by the 1970s. The agricultural sector was just neglected and just collapsed. And it was that way for a lot of different industrial sectors. And so in the 1980s, you eventually get Gorbachev, who was the disciple of Yuri Andropov. Andropov didn't live very long. And he's kind of remembered as this very scary guy, like, you know, so he was the former head of the KGB, and he had this very intimidating demeanor. But Andropov was also someone who was a reformer, but he believed in top-down reform, kind of similar to what had happened in China, where the party renewed the system through an increase in discipline. And you can interpret that any way you want. It sounds quite sinister, especially coming when it's spoken in Russian.
Go on, say it in Russian. Now you've got to say it in Russian now.
No, I can't say it. I don't want to get fussed out again. Every time I speak Russian, people laugh. Anyway, I read it much better than I speak it. No, it's because I have a speech impediment. But anyway, Gorbachev believed in reform, but he believed in reform from the bottom up. And his idea, basically perestroika, was we're going to actually create a law-based state, a state based on the rule of law, and we're going to take all this beautiful language we've written down in the Constitution, and we're going to tweak it to make it work in practice, and we're going to put it into practice, and we're also going to talk about the sins of the past, glasnost, openness. We're also going to talk about all the problems we're having. And you get this big wave of reform throughout the 1980s, and it's not just within the Soviet Union. You have the barbed wire and the walls are coming down all across Europe. You have the fall of the Berlin Wall in 89. So Poland, I believe that's where you're from. You know, you guys have the coup, which was meant to stave off a Soviet intervention because of the growing popularity, and forgive me, I'm not an expert, so you can correct me on anything get wrong, but the growing popularity of the pro-democratic movement, and then that actually invigorates the solidarity movement, the pro-democratic movement, who eventually become a government in waiting and then come into government. Gorbachev, you know, it depends on who you ask about him. People in Vilnius will never forgive him for what happened there, rightfully so, obviously. People in Azerbaijan will never forgive him, but the one thing I've come to understand about him from my various readings of events is he's not someone who was eager for violence, and he's not someone who actively embraced it. He actually did try to want to make things work. And so that's where you stand in 1989, when after a series of changes to the 1977 USSR Constitution and other changes to the 1978 Constitution, you have the first elections in the Soviet Union that are really open since 1917. And now the 1989 election was for the Congress of People's Deputies of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, so all 15 constituent republics, central government. And that was not really a fair election because 10% of the seats were reserved for the party, 10% for the Academy of Sciences. You know, Gorbachev was very careful to make sure the people who were elected were his kind of people. But then in 1990, they kind of forgot about the constituent republics. And you have what is probably one of the biggest elections in human history, because you have simultaneous elections for every local office and for the parliament, the Congress of People's Deputies, across Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia simultaneously. And that's where you actually see a lot of people elected to office who the USSR central government would have preferred not to have been elected to office. And they're really, in my research, I could not find any systemic vote rigging. There was definitely vote rigging that happened, but it was very much at a local level. It was much, very much local party bosses trying to make sure they got a seat in parliament. And that's where you are at the start of the 1990s, where you actually have democratic elected parliaments. But there's something going on which is just more insidious, and they cannot solve the economic issue. And that's where you have the emerging leader of the opposition, Boris Yeltsin, who first was elected to the all-union parliament, but then kind of got shunted into the construction committee, you know, so kind of ignored. And then he gets elected to the Russian parliament in 1990. And in June 1990, the Russian parliament does two things. One, it elects Boris Yeltsin as chairman of the parliament. So essentially, in effect, the prime minister of Russia within the Soviet Union. And Russia declares sovereignty from the USSR. They say Russia is a sovereign state within the USSR, but we have our rights as a sovereign state. And this starts essentially an uncontrolled pushing apart of the Soviet Union from the center outwards. You would think that Russia, as a constituent republic, would be wanting to keep its imperial hegemon over these other states that want out, like the Baltic states, like Ukraine, like the republics in the Caucasus, like Georgia and Azerbaijan and Armenia. It's very interesting in that you have even ultra-Russian nationalists who very much want to kick these states out of the USSR because they think that Russia is essentially subsidizing all of these because of the failing economic system, which is not entirely untrue. It's interesting in that, I'm trying not to go off on a tangent here, but like Russia itself within the USSR, the central government undertook a lot of the functions that would be taken by constituent republic governments in other constituent republics. So the Russians always had a chip on their shoulder about that because they always thought they were getting screwed over by the central government. And so I do think that in 1990, at least, you saw two things. You saw something that approached a genuinely democratic election, and you also saw in society and in discussion, like a genuine desire for democracy. It's very interesting when you read the transcripts from the Congress of People's Deputies, which I have, all 33,000 glorious pages of the first Congress of People's Deputies. People go on and on and on and bash their hands on the table and talk about the need for democratization, the need for rule of law, the need to make the law function as it says it should. And so that's also where they start to construct institutions, including a parliament, including a presidency, and a constitutional court that are supposed to work as functioning democratic institutions within the Russian and Soviet states. So sorry, I felt like I went on a bit of tangent
there. No, it's okay. I'm actually curious from everything you said, because I know we're talking a lot about politics here, and I am a very people-orientated historian. I love the underdogs and the general people. I'm curious to know, in this time period of these supposed free elections, do you know what the average Joe is thinking about and experiencing at all?
Oh, yeah. No. And so this, first of all, it's great you take that approach to history, because history is made up of people, right? First and foremost, it's people's stories. And for the average person, this was a very transformative time. Victor Shainis says that, he's a Russian historian, says that Russians have two settings when it comes to politics: complete mobilization or total apathy. And throughout the 1990s, it was a period of total mobilization. You had really high, you had like 85% turnout for these elections. And the candidates themselves were nominated by local committees, many of whom had self-formed. You had perestroika clubs, which are like just discussion clubs about perestroika and about law and about democratization and about free markets, that were forming in universities, in factories, at social collectives. I mean, people got very engaged. And when they had their first session of the all-union parliament, that was the USSR parliament, productivity dropped something like 70%. I can't use these numbers in my research because they're anecdotal from someone I interviewed, but she remembers being in St. Petersburg at the time and nobody was at work. All the shops were closed, and even like taxis weren't out because everyone was glued to their televisions watching the session of parliament, because this was the first session of a democratically elected parliament that they had ever experienced. And people very much were engaged in this at this point. At the same time, there was a huge amount of frustration because the economic situation was continuing to deteriorate. And Gorbachev's reforms seemed to always be moving too slow. And Gorbachev was not a people person. Like, he was a very smart guy. He was an intellectual. He was a Leninist. And he would go on and on and on. Like, reading his speeches are pure torture, because he just won't shut up. And you're just at a certain point, you just scream.
Was it him? Was it him, or was it Khrushchev who did? Who was in parliament? Who went to the U.S. in the 60s?
Oh, that was Khrushchev.
So was that him? Because Khrushchev had an extremely long speech, but then, God, what was his name? The Cuban guy. Why has my brain died?
Castro
did one that lasted even longer. And it's like this whole speech has just went on all bloody day.
Yeah, there's a joke about how Brezhnev used to fall asleep during his own speeches, like when he was giving the speech. And he was so old at that point, his aide would lean over and put his finger under his nose to make sure he was still breathing. And then they just let him take a 20-minute nap. And then he'd wake up and he'd just resume more or less where he left off. So it made the plenum sessions go extra long. But yeah, so Yeltsin, in contrast. And so Yeltsin had started off as on Gorbachev's team. He was the former party boss of Svorsk, now Yekaterinburg. And he had been invited to run the Moscow Central Committee in 87. And he had made a big splash as a populist politician. He had done a lot of things like taking the bus in the morning or showing up at stores for snap inspections. Always a camera crew with him, or a journalist so it could be publicized, that sort of thing. But he had this real kind of like populist ability to talk to people. And he was the opposite of Gorbachev. Gorbachev was a very high-minded intellectual who thought of himself as intelligentsia. Yeltsin was a former construction manager who liked high-minded ideals, but didn't really understand them and didn't really try to understand them. But he had fantastic political instincts, and he really knew how to read the situation. And he was actually thrown out of, he came to Moscow in 85. He was thrown out, I think, in 87. He lost his job in an internal power struggle and resigned from the Politburo, first person ever to do that. And then it was in 1990 or 1991 that he officially resigned from the Communist Party. And a whole bunch of other deputies of the Congress of People's Deputies for Russia followed him at that party session. They all resigned together. And so Yeltsin had set himself up as the opposition to Gorbachev. And in 1990, he's also like, so in 1991, he also creates the office of president of the Russian Socialist Federated Soviet Republic. Ugh, that's a mouthful. Because Gorbachev had created the office of president of the USSR because he was trying to force through these economic reforms that weren't working. And he thought, if I get more executive authority, and Rezikov was kind of behind this, this was one of Gorbachev's advisors, I can really force it through. Yeltsin uses that as an imperative to set up the office of Russian president. June 12th, 1991, same day I was born, Yeltsin is elected president of the Russian, we'll call it the Russian Federation. And so now he's president of Russia within the USSR. So that's June. He's inaugurated in July. In just a fun side note, what is probably one of the most bizarre inauguration ceremonies I have ever seen, they had a speech from the Grand Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. Bearing in mind, they're still officially communist at this point, right? There's like this strange effort to recapture Russian identity starting in 1990, and they're not quite sure what that is. And also, you've got all the people there from Tatarstan, from, you know, the 100-plus ethnic republics who are just kind of looking around like, you know, we're Russian too, or, you know, we're Tatar, but we're also Russian, you know? So it's like this inability to separate the ethnic and national identities really kind of became a sticking point for them. But so that's July. And then what happens in August, we all know, is the August coup, right? And so that people call that a hardline coup. I don't think the recent scholarship supports that. I think the recent scholarship supports that this was an effort by General Khrushchev, who was the head of the KGB, and other members within Gorbachev's government, essentially to stop Gorbachev from basically giving away the store, because he'd been constantly negotiating with these increasingly strong republics, Russia, but also Ukraine and Kazakhstan, and giving them more and more autonomy. They were supposed to sign a new union treaty that would transform the USSR into a confederated state. And, you know, that's what prompted the coup. But also, all the guys who were the coup plotters were going to lose their job after that treaty was signed. So there might have been a personal element involved in that as well. And so there's the coup. And who becomes the center of the democratic opposition to the coup is Boris Yeltsin. Like I said, keen political instinct, sends his foreign minister out of the country straight away to potentially form a government in exile, negotiates with the lower level military guys, puts himself in front of television cameras, gets in touch with the Americans and the White House. And 3 days later, the coup just completely falls apart. And then Gorbachev comes back, and it's immediately clear that he no longer has even half the authority he used to. And in December, Yeltsin gets together with Kravchuk from Ukraine and Shukrtyla and his colleague from Belarus at a hunting lodge. And the agenda is originally they're going to negotiate inter-republic cooperation for the coming winter. And they're also going to negotiate the status of Ukraine, because remember, this is right after Ukraine has just had a referendum on independence. And it was something like 90% voted for independence. And they also elected Kravchuk as now president of Ukraine. Anyway, so it's Gedi Barbilis, one of Yeltsin's advisors, says, we should just abolish the Soviet Union. And so they do. And they all agree to abolish the Soviet Union. Now, was this legal? This is actually an interesting point of contention. It certainly was for Ukraine, because Kravchuk had a very clear mandate from his people that they didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union anymore. Belarus, it's, you know, there's no clear mandate there. And also, it's interesting because all three of these republics had previously voted in a referendum in March of 1990. March of 1991 to stay within the union. And so it's Yeltsin essentially makes the unilateral decision. Russia is no longer part of the Soviet Union. Well, if you take Russia out of the Soviet Union, what's the point of having a Soviet Union? And it's very interesting. Nazarbayev, who was a big proponent of keeping the union together because Kazakhstan did need the economic assistance, was not in the room, and they essentially ambushed him with it as a fait accompli, and he went along with it. And you know who the first person outside of that hunting lodge to find out that the Soviet Union had ceased to exist? It was the president of the United States.
I was going to say someone like Khrushchev or something.
No, Gorbachev. No, Gorbachev was not told. And Khrushchev wouldn't have known. He was dead by then. But Gorbachev didn't find out until a bit later. And Yeltsin called the president of the United States, George Bush. It's Also worth noting that many people have said Yeltsin was very drunk at this point, and the documents certainly support that.
Really?
You can tell from the phone conversation that Yeltsin's either very excited or has a lot of liquid assistance. And he was known at this point to start drinking. And so Russia is now an independent state in December of 1991. And the Supreme Soviet of the Congress of People's Deputies, which was a standing committee that was elected by the Congress to kind of serve as like.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Functioning parliament. The organization of the Russian parliament is extremely weird and extremely non-functional. I mean, y'all got a pretty combative parliament in Poland, I'm given to understand. And certainly the House of Commons. Yeah, and certainly the House of Commons is quite combative. But man, the parliament in Russia was nuts. So first of all, the Congress of People's Deputies had over 1,000 deputies. 1,066 deputies. No, sorry, 1,068 deputies. And from that number, they elected 250 to serve as the Supreme Council, the Supreme Soviet, who actually would manage things day to day when the Congress was not in session. And then when the Congress all came back into session, they're supposed to come into session once a year, they would vote on everything the Supreme Soviet had discussed. So the Supreme Soviet would like set the agenda, and then the Congress would come together and they'd vote on everything, and then it would become law. But they came into session a lot more than once a year. They were in session 9 times in 3 years, if you include the last session, which was actually during the crisis. So here's where the issue like starts to turn towards violence. So Yeltsin is now president. The parliament is being led by one of Yeltsin's former deputies, Ruslan Khosbolatov, who's actually from Chechnya. As far as I know, doesn't speak a word of Chechen. His family were one of the people who were deported during Stalin's purges. So he actually grew up in Central Asia, was completely Russified, was a economics professor, actually. And from what I can tell, actually quite a good politician. He also, being an economics professor, was an extremely prickly personality and didn't play nice with others. And also the fact he was Chechen made a lot of people very prejudiced against him. There were like 7 ballots, him and Sergei Barbun, who was a center-right, right-wing conservative, went head-to-head to succeed Yeltsin in July of 1991. And then it was only after the August coup that Khosbolatov was confirmed as chairman of the parliament. And he had been Yeltsin's political ally. He had actually been one of the people who had helped get Yeltsin elected chairman of the parliament in the first place. And then there's Alexander Rutskoy, who had been Yeltsin's running mate in 1991. I do need to mention this. So Rutskoy is often shown to be like some kind of Misalovich in the Kremlin in waiting, or I'm sorry, what was the name of the guy who led the coup d'etat in Poland?
Jaruzelski.
Yeah, Jaruzelski. Yeah, he's kind of often portrayed to be similar, like, you know, because he was a military guy, he was an Air Force general. He actually had been awarded Hero of the Soviet Union, but as Yeltsin's running mate, he denounced the violence in Vilnius, and he specifically denounced Gorbachev and said, how long is it until we'll see tanks in the streets of Moscow? And he broke with the conservative party, the communists at this point are the conservatives. He broke and formed the Communist for Democracy faction in parliament, which some people jokingly called the wolves for vegetarianism. So he's the vice president, Kasbulatov is the chairman, and you think, okay, so Yeltsin has these allies in parliament and in the vice presidency, so he's all set, right? Except the presidency and the parliament are competing at this point over power, over who's in charge of what. And there starts to gradually be a diversion in their personal interest as well as their institutional interest. And also Yeltsin was not very good at coalition building. He was very good at giving orders, but he was not very good at working with people and being willing to have a give and take. It was very much, I told you to do this, so you should do this. He even says in his memoirs, I think someone should always be the boss. And he's got this circle of advisors around him. Yuri Petrushev, in particular, comes to everyone's attention. He's actually not very well known, but he became the Secretary of Presidential Administration, and he started to very much limit the information Yeltsin was getting access to. And he also hated Kasbulatov and Rutskoy for various reasons. I think because they tried to get him fired like three times. Anyway, and then at the same time, we have shock therapy, the economic reform, the greatest deconstruction of economics in human history. So during
World War II, did this bring about a whole new constitution, though?
No. That's the thing. They're still working under the 1978 constitution that's been amended like 150 times at this point because they keep amending it. They amend it to, and that's the thing. In the first parliament, they create a constitutional commission run by Boris Yeltsin. He's also, while he's president, he's also the chairman of the constitutional commission, and they're drafting a new constitution. And in July of 1991, there is a new draft of the constitution that's ready to go, but they don't bring it to a referendum, and they don't bring it out of committee. And they don't do that for two reasons. One, the Constitutional Commission, which is elected by the parliament, is constitutional legal experts, wants to have a new federal treaty that will reconcile the relationship between Russia and its federal entities. It's a very convoluted and complex story, but basically Russia was a constituent republic within the USSR, but it was one of the only federalized ones. It had 20 autonomous republics within Russia that were largely based on ethnic, you know, groupings. And so the Constitutional Commission said, we can't just impose a constitution from Moscow on these people. They have to consent to it. Well, you do that through a referendum, but no, they're like, no, we have to have this federal treaty first. But also, and this is my theory, and I'm still trying to prove it, The draft constitution from 91 is actually a glorious piece of balance of power. It is, you can tell the people who did it were actually quite smart. It gave a lot of authority of oversight to the Congress, and it really made the presidency and the parliament co-equal branches, and it made a very strong constitutional court. And Yeltsin obviously was not a fan of any of those things, because as early as 1991, he's talking about dissolving parliament and getting a new parliament, something smaller, more manageable, more obedient. But parliament obviously doesn't want to dissolve itself, because that was the other thing. Obviously, you know, this is Soviet Union. Why do you get elected to parliament? Well, it comes with the perks. You know, you don't get paid if you're a deputy unless you get elected to a committee. But if you get elected to a committee, not only do you get an extra salary on top of your current salary, you also get a Moscow housing permit. You also get a party apartment. You get access to the party dachas, right? The perks. That's what a lot of them were in it for. Wouldn't you be in it for that after suffering
under communism for so long? I mean, clearly I would. I'd like a bit of a perk if I'd had to live, I don't know, in the same type of flat that I've lived in since I was like four. And yeah, having to do a menial job for the whole part of my life. Yeah, I'd definitely get a perk to live in Moscow and get a flat and extra money. Hell yes.
Oh, yeah. And remember, a lot of these people are from like the very rural regions of Russia where indoor plumbing is a luxury. So like to get like a party apartment in Moscow is like, yes, please. I mean, you got to stash your mistress somewhere, right? Yeah, it's Russian politics is quite colorful that way. Anyway, so there's no new constitution, and they're still debating it, basically. And you've got shock therapy. During World War II, the USSR's economy shrank by 24% while you had the fascist Nazis overrunning half the country. During shock therapy, the GDP shrank by over 45%. I mean, it was just massive. It was total economic vandalism. Because you had Gaidar, who Yeltsin picked to run economic reform. And Gaidar was an extremist. Like, even among economists, he was an extremist. He very much believed in shock therapy. He very much believed in monetarism. And he tried to impose that without having any of the administrative or legal safeguards that would allow that kind of economic system to actually function. So what happened was literally people's savings disappeared overnight. I could go on and on about this, but I'll just tell you one anecdote. A British journalist was in Moscow in 1992, and he had just come out of a women's clothing store that catered to a very high-end clientele. Apparently, silk stockings, right? Size 6 for the wives, size 3 for the girlfriends. And he bumps into this old babushka, this old woman, who says, "Excuse me, is this a store for rich people? I need to find a store for rich people because I need to beg." "How do you beg?" I'm an engineer. I've never begged before, but my pension just got stolen. So I need to beg so I can feed myself this month. He gave her a couple hundred bucks. But anyway, it's that kind of like destitution was just universal across common people. So going back to the common people, by this point, people are not just frustrated. They're also horribly destitute because, you know, there was like a sense of economic stability. It was awful, but things just started to disappear left, right, and center. Like literally workers would show up in factories and the building would be empty. Like the machines they had worked on the day before had been taken away on a truck overnight and sold off, and the factory was closed. It was an absolute free-for-all. And so what did they do? Well, a lot of them just tried to survive. A lot of them wrote letters or protested. A lot of them rang their member of parliament. And this started coming up in sessions of parliament. They had two sessions of parliament in 1992, and Yeltsin was horribly, and Gaidar were horribly lambasted for this. And so in the end of 1992, you actually have a session of parliament where they force a compromise. At this point, they've created a constitution.
Tell us a little bit about that, because we've gone through so many of these various different sessions and constitutional changes and everything else, and so much is happening. What is this compromise all about?
Well, this compromise actually was Yeltsin was trying to get Gaidar officially confirmed as prime minister of Russia. And parliament wasn't having that because, like, he's just vandalized the country. We're not giving him more official power because Yeltsin had not confirmed anyone as prime minister since he had been elected president. He essentially just taken the job himself. And parliament was like, "No, you need to confirm. The constitution says we get to confirm the prime minister. You have to nominate someone and we get to confirm him." And they went to the constitutional court, which had just gotten set up and was dealing with a lot of very complex cases. And the constitutional court said, "No, the constitution says you need to nominate a prime minister. So nominate one." And Yeltsin did. He nominated Gaidar. And people absolutely lost it because he was probably the most hated man in Russia at this point. And so they actually forced a compromise where a guy named Viktor Cherniminin, who had formerly been the head of Gazprom and was now part of the parliamentary faction called Civic Union. These guys were later called the Red Directors. A lot of them went on to become oligarchs. And he was made prime minister. And also, they agreed that they would not have new elections because parliament said, "We need to have new elections, but we need to have new presidential elections along with parliamentary elections. And we need to confirm a new constitution because we're not in the USSR anymore. Our current constitution, which has now been amended over 200 times, because they keep amending it to keep address the issues as they come up in each of these sessions, is not fit for purpose." And Yeltsin said, "Okay, we do need a new constitution and we do need elections, but only for parliament, because I have a mandate. And my mandate is good for 5 years." And so they kept going back and forth on that. And they finally agreed, "Okay, we'll have a referendum in April of 1993 on, do you trust the president? Do you support the economic reforms? Do you trust the parliament? Should there be elections?" And it was, should there be elections? Yeah. Do you trust the president? Yeah. Anyway, so it was four questions. And that's where we got the first Russian election jingle. Da, da, niet, da. Which is yes, yes, no, yes. That was from the Yeltsin camp. Because they wanted three questions, yeses, and they wanted one that was no. They didn't want presidential elections. And so you actually have a compromise. And it's interesting though. Like just a couple of days after they have this compromise in parliament, Andrei Kozarev, the Russian foreign minister goes on a complete tirade at the OSCE meeting. People thought he was speaking under duress. They thought there might be a coup because he goes on this Russian nationalistic tirade. Then he comes back to the podium sheepishly after the break and explains, if you don't support Yeltsin, this is what you're going to get. So Kozarev's on Yeltsin's team, and Kozarev and Yeltsin are setting up this binary for the West. This very, very stark binary. You've got Yeltsin, who is a Democrat. He's not. But you've got Yeltsin, who's a Democrat, or you've got, like, the worst possible, you know, Mosolovich-esque Saddam in Moscow sort of guy who's going to come in. And, I mean, Rutskoy, again, even though the guy was not very smart, his former commanding officer told a U.S. diplomat one time, when there's four airplanes, there's no one better than Rutskoy. As soon as you add a fifth, everything goes to hell. Right? He wasn't very bright. One diplomat called him a Tsarist cavalry officer, but I don't think he was like a frothing, crazed nationalist. But people were scared, you know, rightfully so. But consider, I mean, you're from Poland, you know, this, you know, you mentioned Russia, and this, you're going to get a lecture on certain things. So this was
a very long-ass lecture.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, this sets us up for 93. There's the referendum in April, which Yeltsin wins technically. And then in the fall, he essentially issues an edict saying, I'm abolishing parliament based on the outcome of this referendum. And I'm also abolishing the constitution, and parliament must disband, and we'll have new elections in December. And we'll also simultaneously that we're voting for a new parliament, vote for a new constitution, which I have written. Or which he had commissioned, which had gone, actually, it was Sergei Shakraya, who was kind of one of his personal lawyers, who took basically all the stuff the Constitutional Commission had worked on over 3 years, took the bits Yeltsin liked, and took everything else out. And that was the constitution he was going to present. And so you get the standoff in Moscow starting on the 21st of September. The parliament impeaches Yeltsin, and Rutskoy is inaugurated as the new president. And the Constitutional Court upholds Yeltsin's impeachment and also smacks down his executive order. Okay, right. But what happens is Yeltsin refuses to leave office because he says, no, the parliament's disbanded. He cordons off the parliament building with troops and tanks and police. And Rutskoy and Khasbulatov essentially panic because up to this point, parliament had had the law on its side, but Yeltsin had the legitimacy. And Yeltsin, most importantly, had the guys with guns on his side. Because the first thing Rutskoy does, because he's an idiot, is he appoints a new defense minister of defense and a new secure interior minister, right? Because the guys currently in power are people who are close to Yeltsin. And so, of course, the guys who are currently in power, who are actually in the command center, are going to go with Yeltsin, because otherwise they're going to lose their jobs. And jobs are hard to come by in Russia at this point, right? And so, there's a standoff, and parliament calls out supporters. It's not as big as they thought it was, but it's a good couple tens of thousands. And it's worth noting, yes, there were a lot of really odious and nasty elements in the parliamentary defenders. You had neo-Nazis, you had Russian ultra-nationalists, but you also had liberals, you had Democrats, you had social Democrats. One guy I interviewed, Oleg Romstayev, he is the deputy chair of the Constitutional Commission. He was on the parliament side of the barricades because he'd been working on the Russian constitution for 3 years. And he wanted to preserve and uphold the rule of law, and he wanted to preserve and uphold democracy. Anyway, eventually, clashes break out between the two sides. Rutskoy basically panics and says, let's storm the TV tower and start a revolution. And so they try to, and the army gets called in. Interestingly, Yeltsin, the first Soviet leader ever first Russian leader ever to agree to give a written order for the army to crack down on protest. It had always been oral before that. And that's why the defense minister held out for a written order, because previously, when things had gone wrong in like Vilnius or Tbilisi or Baku, the army had been blamed. So it's like, no, you're going to sign the order. And Yeltsin's like, yeah, sure, here. And so they bring in the tanks, probably some of the exact same tanks that had been involved in the August coup just 2 years before, manned by the exact same men. And they start firing on the parliament building with cannons. And some people said, oh, it was dummy ammunition. No. It was high explosive ordnance. It set the building on fire. 150 people are killed. Over 500 are wounded, including an American Marine who was on duty at the U.S. Embassy, because it's right across the street from the parliament building. And Parliament surrenders. And Yeltsin basically says, you know, if you give up, you'll get an amnesty. You know, if you give up before the shooting starts, you'll get an amnesty. About half of them gave up before the shooting started. And then the rest of them gave up and were arrested. And then Yeltsin calls his election in 93. And we get the constitution that Russia is governed under to this day. It's called a super presidential constitution. It essentially gives the president massive amounts of power, makes parliament a body of petitioners, and takes away a lot of the power of the court. Yeltsin disbands the court temporarily. A lot of the newspapers who wrote in support of parliament are closed and then later reopened, but taken over by people who were on Yeltsin's side. And this is where you get the patronal political system that continues to govern Russia to this day. And there's one little anecdote I want to pick up on, though, because I think it really illustrates. This wasn't just about Yeltsin versus the parliament or Khasbolatov and Rutskoy versus Yeltsin. This was about institutions. This was about rule of law versus political expediency. And there's a microcosm of that when you see what happened to Oleg Romstayev. Remember, I mentioned him. He was the deputy chair of the Constitutional Commission. Man worked for 3 years to draft a functional Russian constitution. He had been in the parliament building. When the parliament building surrendered, as he was leaving, he was set upon by a group of riot police and brutally beaten and robbed, and essentially just left on the sidewalk, and a friend had to take him to the hospital. That is the kind of arbitrary violence by the Russian state that he had spent the last 3 years to try to ensure would not happen again. And that's what we have now, is a Russian state that is very arbitrarily violent and a state that is supreme above the law. This was the question. Does the state answer to the law, or does the law obey the state? And in Russia, the law obeys the state. It's legal because we say it is, right? And then, of course, Yeltsin picked Putin as his successor, because Putin agreed not to prosecute his daughters, who were horrible thieves, for all their looting of the public purse. And Putin has stayed in power for a very long time. And when he came into power in the early 2000s, God knows what goes on in that guy's head, but he might've been a political pragmatist, but there's no institutional safeguards as he's gotten older and more isolated and more beset by dreams of Russian empire, you know? So what really bothers me about all of this is, at the time, universally in the West, Yeltsin was praised for how he handled the situation. And it was just political expediency. There was one Russian politician in Germany at the time who was stunned that the left-wing German party he was at a conference with were very supportive of Yeltsin. He's like, what would happen in Germany if the chancellor had dissolved the parliament and declared the constitution null and void? And they said, oh, but Germany's not Russia. So yeah, this is what my PhD research is about. So
Jeff, it's been really interesting. I mean, got a lot of information and a lot of things people can take, especially when it comes down to modern politics right now and Putin and what's going on in Russia itself. So I really appreciate getting a bit of a download. Makes a bit more sense. The world makes a little bit more sense. And we've got to get you back on to come and do something else, because that was really interesting. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was glad. I was afraid I was losing you there, but then we have the camera on and I could see your eyes just getting more and more engrossed in what I was saying. I was like, oh, okay. So actually,
I want to punch people. That's why the eyes were going. Because I was off on tapes. My eyes are rolling, going, oh.
I know. And what's the funny thing is like in 1990 to 1991, 92, you had a possibility for a genuine change in Russia. There was the will, there was the consensus, there just was not the leadership. But that's the other thing is Yeltsin was someone who was very malleable, who was very sensitive to international opinion. And like he more than once raised the possibility of abolishing parliament, especially with the American administration, especially with the Bush and Clinton administrations. And they basically were like, oh, yeah, go ahead. Because like, who needs the rule of law, right? Rule of law is for us. That's not for other people. And then I'm American, obviously. So this is something that's become increasingly timely as I've worked on it, because I started working on it in 2020. And then obviously there was the whole January 6th incident. And yeah, no. So political expediency versus the rule of law, in my opinion, in the short term, political expediency might look like the good option, but in the long term, you always have to focus on institutional governance and the rule of law. Otherwise, you don't know where the path will lead, because everyone kept saying, if you don't support Yeltsin, you're going to get war in Eastern Europe. You're going to get a revanchist Russia. Well, that's what we bloody well got. And I don't think this was inevitable. I don't think this was inevitable. I think this was a byproduct of the failure to build institutional safeguards against this sort of thing happening. And it's so fascinating because in 1992, blink and you'll miss it, but you see a parliament and a court restraining the president from policy he wants to enact. And the president has to go along with it.
Well, can we go back in time? No, we can't. I wish we could. Maybe things would be different today. We are where we are. So it's been really great. Let's come back and do some more stuff. Something might change that we might be able to work on and add to this podcast. So we'll definitely have you back to talk a bit more about modern 20th century history.
Yeah. All right. That sounds great. And thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Perfect.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.